Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. All right, so I'm going to do my best to make this not too long of a show today. Average time as the old Daily Wrap-Ups used to be. A lot of exciting stuff coming this week. Lots of interviews coming up in the next couple of weeks. A lot of things to prepare for. So just be prepared for that. I've got a lot of exciting things. One coming up with Holochain, which is a decentralized internet creator that I really want to get on here and talk with and, you know, discuss some future possibilities for things moving forward. In general, though, there's a lot of content that I need to go over the next couple of weeks. There won't be a TLAB research and review following up this show today because I need to prepare for these upcoming interviews. I will be on Fault Lines live radio show in Washington, D.C. tomorrow morning. I'll try and include a link if I can for that, so stay tuned. I want to begin today by touching on something quick that I felt very relevant in regard to some of the topics that we've been going over lately. I was watching an episode of Redacted Tonight with Lee Camp. I think this was the video itself with a lot of content in it, but there was one point that really stood out to me, something that I feel like a lot of us are actually aware of, but weren't maybe aware of, and I wasn't at least, how far back this actually goes to understand that they always sell us this two-party system. That's the majority, right? Most people in this country are either Republican or Democrat. That's what they want you to think. Turns out that's not actually the case. Where Lee Camp shows us essentially that the majority, in fact, is independent. And you may say, oh, well, that's just recent. That's just now. However, I went back. Turns out there's a poll from 1988 to 2011, all the way back then, from 1988 to 2011, that shows apparently that 40% from the Gallup poll, 40% of Americans are independent. 40%. Then, okay, well, maybe that was a fluke. Let's go to the next one from 88 to 2016 shows us, oh, look, that 39% is, in fact, independent. Coming all the way to the one that he showed us today, dating from last month, shows us that 39% of Americans are independent. So what that means, why that's relevant, we're talking about why our vote no longer matters, why the system is broken, why all these things are meant to manipulate you. Well, they're selling you and only showing you two very specific groups, two monolithic parties, as if it represents everyone, when in fact, the very clear majority for decades has been neither Republican nor Democrat. So ask yourself, with all the independents, libertarians, any kind of ideology out there that's actually running for some kind of a political position that doesn't get discussed by the media, ask yourself why that is. Why do they withhold the party of the majority of Americans? Something to think about. I found that to be quite profound, even though I kind of knew this was the case, to see that the stats date all the way back to 1988 and before, being the majority of Americans don't recognize Republican or Democrat. And the fact that I wasn't even aware of that, it shows you how aggressive their propaganda is to make you think that you need to acquiesce to one party or the other. You need to say, okay, well, this is the majority. We're in a democracy, as they say, so we need to bend to one side or the other. The reality is they're misleading you as they are with everything else. They did not give you the best representation with the midterms or the presidential elections because they keep the anything but Republican or Democrat from your eyes. I found that to be very profound. I don't know about you, but we'll keep track of these kind of things as they go forward. You know how I feel about voting in general, but I want people to recognize that you're not being represented by the system that they put in front of you. Now, for the bulk story of the day, this one, I couldn't even believe my eyes when I saw this today because I just reported on this yesterday of being in the works. Sadly, I saw that this was how it was going to go in my eye, in my mind, but to see it actually happen is quite shocking. From antiwar.com, entitled, In Close Vote, House Blocks Debate on Yemen War. Now understand, we're not talking about blocking a specific bill or a specific act. We're talking about blocking general debate on the idea of Yemen. Why that's even a possible discussion point is well beyond me. But they actually did it, and they voted to block the debate further on the war. And seriously, with everything that's going on, I'm quite shocked about this. I'm really quite shocked. Now, before we even get into this article, to show you that there are other people that are actually talking about this, even in Congress, that have a very, very strong belief of why we should be discussing Yemen. And this was taped before that they actually passed the decision to block debate on this. This coming from, and by the way, Ro Khanna, I believe is how you pronounce his name. In no way am I representing him or endorsing him. There's plenty of things I've seen him say about Assad and Syria, for example, that I think are absolutely ridiculous, just progressing the propaganda. That being said, what he says here about Yemen, I do agree with. And it shows you that it's not as clean cut as they want you to think it is, especially in politics.
I rise in strong opposition to this rule that will deny members of Congress an up or down vote about whether the United States should be complicit in the war in Yemen. Let's be very clear. This is unprecedented. In American history, never has the Speaker of the House and the majority denied a member of Congress a vote on matters of war and peace. This is basically rendering ineffectual the War Powers Act. The War Powers Act was passed in a bipartisan fashion after Vietnam because our nation said, never again are we going to make the mistake of Vietnam. We're going to make sure that if a member of Congress calls for a vote, that members of Congress have the Article 1, Section 8 responsibility to vote on matters of war and peace. And what the majority is saying, that if the President of the United States and the Speaker believe we should be in war, we should be in war. It doesn't matter what members of Congress think. That's what they are doing with this rule. Now, they are arguing that we are not complicit in the hostilities of Yemen to invoke the War Powers Act. But you read every article written on this in the international press or national press, and it starts with a simple line: the U.S.-backed Saudi coalition efforts in bombing. Of course we're complicit. Do you think people in Yemen don't think we're complicit? Do you think people in the Middle East or our allies don't think we are complicit? With due respect, Congressman Newhouse says, well, why not wait? Why not wait a few weeks until we're in the majority? Congressman Newhouse, Special Envoy Griffith and every report has said that 500,000 children will die. 500,000 children will die in the matter of months. They don't have aid. They don't have nutrition. And let's be very clear on what we're doing. While we're bombing the ports of Hodeida, we are not allowing food and aid to get to those kids. And when history is written, they're not going to say Jim McGovern did this, or Ro Khanna did this, or Newhouse did this. They're going to say, how did the Congress not allow a vote while hundreds of thousands of kids were not allowed food and medicine? That's not the America that I believe in. It's not the America that so many Republican colleagues believe in. There's a reason that our founders gave Congress the power over war and peace, because we have to go and answer to our constituents. And I'll tell you something, there's not a single American who wouldn't want the violence to end and allow food and medicine to get to those kids who are gonna face death if we do nothing. I plead with my Republican colleagues, please vote no on this resolution. Let's have a debate. Let's have a debate about the starvation and the killing going on there, and do the right thing for our Constitution and the world. I yield back the balance of my time.
Gentlemen's time's expired.
So if you can really digest everything, there's a lot to take in there. This, well, like I said, he spoke before they had decided no longer there was no longer going to be a debate about Yemen. And what he's saying there, you have to understand that there, first of all, it's important to recognize that there are many other people, even in Congress, that agree with what we are saying. Despite the fact they try to gaslight us and make us feel like we're crazy for pointing out things that they're clearly pointing out within Congress themselves. Like he said, they have all the data. They're well aware that children are going to die. They're well aware that people are starving to death, and their actions are going to continue to starve them to death. You understand what he's saying there? They all know this. They're all making a conscious choice, those that voted for this, to ignore that for political reasons. And again, I have to, being so close to midterms, have to point out these are the people that we voted for. If you chose to vote, these are the people. They're making this conscious choice. The simple fact, there are members in Congress, more and more of them every day. So Tulsi Gabbard is another one. And I'm not saying I believe in their politics or even them in general, but there are people more and more every day who strongly disagree with the U.S. oligarchy's stance on Yemen. And it should show us, at the very least, that this topic is not as open and shut as they try to make it seem when confronted by the independent media coverage of Yemen. It's not. People understand what the United States oligarchy is doing in Yemen. And now they've actually passed this. They've actually stopped the debate altogether. They're no longer, I mean, think people will try to circumvent that. But it's something that it was shocking to me to wake up to today. Now back to the article itself. Now that they voted on this coming from anti-war, this is the Congress moving forward in regard to Yemen. Now this happened yesterday. And of course, the vote was heavily along party lines. The House passed it's called Manage Our Wolves Act, which is funny in a way that it almost is perfect, but I'll explain, many of you likely already know why it's called that. And it passed 201 to 187. The vote effectively blocked all debate on the war in Yemen. I repeat, the vote blocked all debate on anything in regard with Yemen and the U.S. involvement in the horrible genocidal war therein, and precluded that conflict from coming up for a future vote. Not only did it stop the debate, it stopped their ability to even try to create votes on this subject going forward. I mean, can we not see what's really happening here? The Americans are well aware there's something bad happening there, and they literally just said, we don't care what you think, and we're going to make sure that the rest of anybody that might actually care here in Congress might have still a little bit of morals clinging to them. We're going to make sure that they can't even talk about it anymore. Now, this is the second straight year that an attempt to challenge America's unauthorized involvement in the Yemen war, if you can call it that, under the War Powers Act, has been actually derailed by House leadership through last-minute rule changes. Understand, this is how this stuff works. Not normal ways of things, but manipulative last-minute rule changes to change the people's ability to talk about this. Now, this time, it required tying the rule change to a vote randomly about gray wolves. That's how politics works in this country. They're called riders in a lot of times, where they slip in very important things in massive bills and don't show people to the last second. So they pass something they think everybody's on board with, and it turns out they authorized indefinite detention of Americans or something crazy like that. And it's happened in the past. Now, of course, they point out this led to a very bizarre situation where they were literally debating the constitutionality of the Yemen war on one side of the area, and then on the other side they were talking about their desire to shoot gray wolves. It made absolutely no sense, and it was almost comical how ridiculous it was. And they know this, though, and this was, of course, meant to give cover to lawmakers to say when they're confronted about it later by those that actually are aware of what they're trying to do, that they can say, oh, we were voting on wolves instead of the unpopular U.S.-backed Saudi-led war. This was about killing wolves. That was just a side note. So that's how they do this. But the takeaway here at the end of the day is that under cover of night, if you want to call it, by some idea about a bill about shooting wolves, they voted to no longer allow Congress to discuss the concept of U.S. criminal actions in Yemen off the table. I don't know how much more evidence we need to see that shows you that these people are not on our side, but damn it if this isn't a startling, startling example of their ability to just remove the possibility to discuss one of the worst humanitarian crises, if not the worst in human history. If we can see this over 18 to 20 million people starve to death, which is what they're allowing to happen, this will be the worst humanitarian crisis in the history of the human race, as far as I can tell, at least in living memory. So please do something about this. Speak out, talk to people, contact your representatives if you think it will make a difference. They're trying to hide this from you once and for all. Now, in a related story, something somebody shared with me in regard to Yemen as well, and highlighting not just that they're now currently lying to you and trying to manipulate the situation, but they have been from the start. And all the ceasefires and peace talks and deals and discussions from the very beginning, they've been planning to do what they've been doing. And now it's been leaked that we find out that's true. This coming from Military Times, entitled, "This Classified Operation Supports the Saudi Military Campaign in Yemen." Now, of course, the operation they're talking about is called Yukon Journey 1, anyway. That, interestingly, got, I guess, accidentally posted on their website, and they changed it. It wasn't extremely classified, but it was classified. And of course, we now find out that this operation that they accidentally leaked shows you that from the very beginning, they've completely, unwaveringly supported the Saudi efforts in Yemen. Now, in the unclassified version that was first released, this was made to look like an effort to go after ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Does that sound familiar? The same cover they use on just about everything? But yet now, after the accidentally leaked operation comes out, it shows us that it was in fact about specifically finding Houthi missiles, which is interesting, and was also specifically focused on unfettered, unwavering support for the Saudis in the Yemen invasion. This is U.S. ground troops on the ground. A dedication to Saudi goals. That's what we're talking about here. All long before all the rhetoric and outright lies that we've been hearing from the U.S. oligarchy and their stooges. Thank you for the super chat, Northern Lights. This is important to understand that this Yukon journey shows us that from the very beginning, they used the cover of fighting terrorism to back the Saudis in their war against the rightfully elected representatives in Yemen. And that is the truth, by the way. That the Hadi government was put in there by the U.S. before this. At that time, it was a coup, and they unseated the democratically elected government and put him in place. And then when they tried to have these peace talks the last time, the Houthis were trying to come to the table and discuss it, but the Saudis wouldn't even allow them to go. Threatened them, threatened to shoot down there. The point is, they've done everything they can to stop this from actually going forward in a positive way. And their focus has been on the Houthi rebels from the very beginning because they support the people and not the governments. And they're talking about U.S. group troops on the ground for how long now? That's a good question. And here's a clip I wanted to show you from RT discussing this specifically that I found to be very, very revealing.
Why are we even involved at this stage in Yemen in any way, in any form, especially financing?
Well, it was meant to assist the coalition led by Saudi Arabia. Now, that's probably being cut back. And I think this is where the conflict and the concerns come in, because that portion was supposed to have been stopped. But then this inadvertent revelation came out, and it shows that we have special operations on the ground and being financed by our contingency operations portion of the defense budget. That's an entirely separate budget that covers special ops, and their job is to assist on the ground. It's more tactical, so that they can then direct the Saudis to take them out in Yemen.
Thank you, Jason, for the super chat. You didn't get to see it on the screen, but I appreciate the support, my friend. He said, yeah, boy, Vagabond getting fired up. It does bother me, this kind of blatant attempt to suppress the discussion of one of the worst things happening in the world, especially when the very people that they're suppressing it are the ones that are directly involved with keeping it up. It's very frustrating, but that video was profound. That is a Pentagon, excuse me, that gentleman has insight into what's going on in the Pentagon. He's speaking on behalf of what we're talking about with the Yukon journey, and understanding that this means that they've had their support there from the very beginning, and that we're talking about U.S. troops on the ground and the money, the important part that he touches on, where that's coming from, the budget. That's directly, when I talk about your tax dollars funding these horrible things, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Now, this is not talking about selling them weapons, support on the ground. They are using our tax dollars to fund a special program from the beginning of this to help the Saudis attack the rightful government of Yemen. That's what we're funding. That's what you're paying for with your tax dollars. Something we really need to rectify and come to grips with as Americans, that we're increasingly on the wrong side of history today. And now they're trying to stop us from even talking about it. Moving on to the next story coming from antimedia.com. This one showing us in regard to the U.S. war of terror around the world and how much it's actually costing us, which is quite shocking. Entitled, "The U.S. has spent $5,900,000,000 on war, just war, since 2001. Guess who pays for that? Yeah, you guessed right. It's you. You do, as an American, if you're an American. You pay for that. More than half of your tax dollars go right there. For what? What has it accomplished? It's made Afghanistan a worse place. It's made Iraq a worse place. It's made Libya a profoundly worse place. It's clearly made Syria more destabilized. On and on and on and on. It's starving people in Yemen. It is continually the similar situation in Venezuela. I mean, it's just on and on. This is what your tax dollars go to. Now, this report from Brown University is aiming to provide a close estimate of the overall cost to the U.S. government of its myriad post-9/11 wars and assorted global wars on terror, of terror, however you want to look at it. Thank you, James, for the super chat. The estimate is that $5.933 trillion has been spent through fiscal year 2019. Almost $6 trillion. Now, that's almost an unfathomable amount of money to the average person. Made almost more that much more ridiculous when you take a moment and realize that the Pentagon simply can't account for $21 trillion, which is also just kind of coincidentally happens to be the same as our national debt. What do you know about that? But unrelated slightly, but the point is $6 trillion spent just on wars of aggression around the world that you're paying for. Now, this is, of course, the number itself vastly higher than official figures that you get from the Pentagon, similar to the way that they dramatically undershoot the people that they kill around the world. And owing to the Pentagon trying to oversimplify the costs, of course, and to simply oversees contingency operations, and that's it. It's only when one considers the cost of medical and disability care for soldiers and future such costs, along with things like the interest on the extra money borrowed maybe for the wars, that the true cost becomes staggeringly clear. Of course, that staggering amount is only the costs and obligations of the war so far. And with little sign of them ending, and every indication that they are increasing, even creating new fields of war, that amount is only going to grow exponentially. Starting in late 2001, the U.S. has engaged in wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Pakistan, Yemen, and on and on. I could spend an entire show listing the places where the U.S. is engaged militarily and largely illegally. And many of those wars have become more or less permanent operations, which almost in a way makes it no longer war, but it's just an occupation, with no consideration of ending them under any circumstances. See, now that is not about spreading democracy or liberty or freeing an oppressed people. That is about dominance. That is about hegemony and control. That is about neocolonialism, which is what we're seeing. And truly, I think that many people, more people than I've ever thought, are beginning to wake up to this fact. Hopefully that's because of what we're doing here, at least in part. But spread the word of what your tax dollars are actually going to. Now, in the next story coming from South Front, this one is a very interesting story in regard to, and is the final story of the day, trying to make this a shorter show, the reality of what, again, it's kind of all tied in when you really look at it, with the war on terror, the what we're spending in regard to Syria, how they've always wanted regime change in Syria. From the moment that they got there, from 25 years before that, about destabilizing it, they've been planning this for a very long time. But now with everything gone to hell in Syria, their plan's not working. Everything they're trying to accomplish seems to be failing, while Assad, with the help of Russia, seems to be holding on to his rightful sovereign territory, go figure. They're now doubling down and making sure we're aware that they're still going after regime change in Syria. They're just not calling it regime change, and they're saying that they're there for ISIS, but we're not going to leave until this changes in the Syrian government. Of course, the flip, that's how they always cover it. This entitled U.S. Envoy to Syria exposes Assad's evil plan to create ISIS and provoke U.S. military intervention. Now, I think they forgot their quotations in that title. I know that's meant to be sarcastic, especially when you read it. You could literally put that entire thing in quotes. U.S. envoy to Syria exposes Assad's evil plan. That's really what it should be around. But the point is they're literally making the claim that Assad is completely responsible for ISIS. Just casually disregarding facts and history and recognizable points of action from the United States government that happened well before this all started with Syria. But, you know, who cares about facts? You know, facts. Who cares? We'll just listen to what the United States government has to say. And it's ISIS or Assad's fault. And then Iran, just because. That's what we're seeing here. And it's quite staggering. Now, the Trump administration is still very adamant. And that's the important point here. On regime change by any means in Syria, which you won't really hear them say. However, when you listen to Mike Pompeo's special representative for Syria, James Jeffrey, he makes it pretty damn clear yesterday what they're actually trying to accomplish. And I'll let you watch that for yourself.
We also think that you cannot have an enduring defeat of ISIS until you have fundamental change in the Syrian regime and fundamental change in Iran's role in Syria, which contributed greatly to the rise of ISIS in the first place in 2013-2014. Based upon these three elements, we hope to see a process, again, as outlined, as laid out in that UN Security Council resolution, moving forward to encourage all of the actors in Syria to achieve a basic security system that will end the fighting permanently, produce a Syrian regime that is not as toxic as the current one is to its own people and to the neighborhood, and secure satisfactory guarantees for all of the players in and around Syria.
So you can see pretty damn clear, not only what he's stating is just so easily demonstrably false. It's almost shocking what they feel they can say without any repercussions today. But the reality here is he's making very clear that it's we're there for ISIS, but we can't leave until Assad changes, and then we'll finish going after ISIS. It doesn't really make sense. I mean, it never really has. It's one day it's about Iran, the next day it's about Assad, the next day it's about ISIS. It's really, you know, the excuse de jure, whatever makes the most sense for their agenda in that moment. So, and this was, I believe it was yesterday, or it might have been today, but Special Envoy on Syria, James Jeffrey, which you just saw, he said that U.S. troops will not withdraw from Syria before ensuring that, quote, the enduring defeat of ISIS. So at face value, you go, okay, so they're trying to fight ISIS. That's what they're going with now. But then he says, which can't happen without changing the behavior of the Damascus government, Iran. So you go, okay, wait a minute. That doesn't kind of really make sense because they're not, you know, they're two separate things. But that's how he ties it all together by saying, and that makes sense because Assad created ISIS. Now they tied it up in a nice, neat little bow. All of their multifaceted propaganda that they couldn't even wrap their arms around, they've now kind of tied up in this really disorganized bow to make it all seem to make sense to the average person that doesn't do any research into the things they're talking about. Now, when Jeffrey was asked to explain his claims about the Damascus government and Iran supposedly creating ISIS, Jeffrey blamed Damascus for the violence in Syria, which allowed the terrorist organization to emerge in both Syria and Iraq somehow, even though the timeline doesn't work that way, according to his own words. He said, quote, the Syrian regime produced ISIS, point blank. The elements of ISIS in the hundreds probably saw an opportunity in the total breakdown of civil society and the upsurge of violence as the population rose up against the Assad regime, and the Assad regime, rather than trying to negotiate or try to find any kind of solution, unleashed massive violence against its own population with the same old canard that we know isn't true. It's been proven to be false. Now, the reality here, what he's saying, almost his statement there almost contradicts itself. Very clearly saying that ISIS already existing saw the destabilization of Syria and chose to go there. So in and of itself, he's right there saying that they didn't create ISIS, even though that's what he's claiming. Rather, that they rose it to what it is now, which is quite different than what he's actually saying. But they don't care about these little fine points. They just put out what they want you to hear, and then they just kind of they assume that no one's really going to follow up and do the research. But when you read what he's saying there, that, and of course the total breakdown of civil society, they just leave out how that happened, despite the, you know, U.S. invading Syria and why it all started. That's side notes. The reality is that the society broke down, and then Assad chose to just murder his own people, and ISIS grew. End of story. That's what he's basically saying. The theory claiming that the Assad regime created ISIS was initially promoted by the Syrian opposition to justify its failure to neutralize the radical elements within its ranks, or, you know, allow them to thrive, which is what I think is the case. Jeffrey initially ignored the seemingly countless actions of the U.S. that clearly, verifiably, demonstrably allowed ISIS to arise and gain influence in the Middle East. Now, when he's talking about Iraq, this is well before the Syrian conflict as we know it today began. And we know that in a large way, Iraq is where this really took its stride, where you're talking about Al-Qaeda, ISIS, just extremism in general, as we know it today, was created because of U.S. actions in Iraq, or stoked. I mean, this dates all the way back to the creation of the Taliban. But the reality they're trying to pin this on Assad is so see-through. It's laughable to anyone that actually knows. It almost makes me think they want people like us to see that they're lying. It's staggering. Now, despite the above-mentioned accusations from Jeffrey, he said that his government is not seeking the regime change in Syria. Basically like saying, we want to see the overthrow of the government of Damascus, but we don't want regime change. You know, that's how ridiculous it is, because they're, according to them, they just want to see a change in the behavior of the Damascus government. And if that behavior can change by putting someone new in place, then there, we change their behavior. It's rhetoric and how they're changing it. And of course, it's highlighted about Iran. It's about changing their behavior toward Iran, which is, it shows you the reality from the beginning of what this is all about. He goes, he actually says, we're not about regime change, we're about a change in behavior. That's literally a quote from him. Jeffrey's statements show that one of the current main U.S. goals of Syria is, in fact, to force Iran to withdraw from the war-torn country, even if this means repeating ISIS or Al-Qaeda propaganda on the highest level. It's all about Iran. They will lie through their teeth. We have to see that, you know, this is how they use the wholly manufactured war on terror, war of terror, fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS, as a way to lay cover for their real agenda. Just as we now know, for a fact, mind you, that that's what's taking place in Yemen because of their leaked documents. Due to the release of the Operation Yukon Journey, we know this. They use the cover of fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS for the justification for their operation, and then went in and just joined the Saudis in attacking the government of Yemen. And not to mention the side note of the UAE-funded American assassins that murdered Yemen politicians, but we don't talk about that, even though it's clearly recognized. They lied about fighting terrorists. They lie every day about fighting terrorists, and they work alongside those very terrorists on the ground. That's what we're seeing in Yemen. That's what we're seeing here in Syria. And this is not some kind of conspiracy theory. This has been verified by the Associated Press. Not even that in and of itself should just make it a fact. But hopefully that drives it home for some people that may be doubting it. There's more than one. This is a recognizable fact that the United States is working directly with Al-Qaeda on the ground in Yemen, as well as other places such as Syria, such as Iraq. This is what they do, if not completely created it from the get-go, which is what I think, like we can prove. But the reality here, the facts of the table, is that this is how they accomplish what they're doing. They lie to you about what they're doing there, and they use that as a cover to carry out the same old things they've been doing. So why would we still believe their lies about what's taking place in Syria from Jeffries and what they're really there to accomplish? That's something that we each need to ask ourselves as this goes forward. Why would we believe them once we can see very clearly that they're lying in a very similar situation and doing the very same thing? These people are career liars. That's what they do. So hopefully this will wake some people up and get the information out there. Thank you for tuning in today. Lots of good information to get out there. So make sure you spread this out. Make sure you, literally, sorry, I'm laughing at myself as I look up at my whiteboard and it says, ping, right there. Don't forget to ping, which I did today. My apologies for those on the Wire app, but I'm trying to get more people to join up for the Wire app. Make sure I'll ping for the show going live every time, even though I forgot to do it today. It's a good way to circumvent the ability of YouTube to stop you from getting that notification. Anyway, on that note, make sure you tune in tomorrow morning on Fault Lines. I'll be live around 7:40 Mountain Time. Got a lot of big interviews coming up, so stay tuned for all of that. Thank you for tuning in today. And as always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
Lasers. Sound like the stuff of science fiction, right? Sound completely unbelievable. How could our military possibly be using those in future warfare? Guess what? We've just had a recent breakthrough, more great test results that are making lasers a reality. So it's called Athena. Lockheed Martin makes it, and they've been doing a lot of the pioneering in this laser field. Now, what's really exciting about it is that it's so hard to harness that much power and make it compact enough that it's actually going to make practical sense downrange. And they've proven that they can do that. Recently, they tested it against 5 moving drones, so realistic drones that they might go up against with enemy forces might send against us, for example, or terrorists might send against us. and it successfully shot down all five of the drones. This is huge news because it means that in a realistic, practical setting, it's looking very promising, so it could be ready to field quite soon. So when you see the movies or you look at comic books or television shows, when you see laser weapons, they tend to be a color, right? Red or green or something like that. Real lasers, one of the key advantages that they provide is that they are invisible. You actually can't see them. You just see this damage suddenly starting to blow something up. So if we take a look now at what the Athena did to a truck. So we're looking at a truck engine, and the Athena within seconds was able to beam right in there, heat the whole thing up, and burn through the engine of this vehicle. So if you can imagine if you were in that vehicle, all of a sudden, this hole would start appearing in your engine, and the whole thing would just disappear. That's what these lasers do.